It's the Wonky Show. Keir Starmer has U-turned over student fees and finance. We'll work out why. Plus, support for PGRs is in the news. Universities are fundraising pretty frantically. And disadvantaged students go on to be lower earning graduates. But why? It's all coming up.
You know, broadly speaking, it's about where it is now, but just a bit more to make it easy. And I still think, you know, we are not talking enough around the derisory increase for the maintenance loans next year. And I haven't heard any party take this on at all.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, and here to chew the HE meat in this bank holiday sandwich that we're in, as usual, three fabulous guests. In Gravesend, Selina Bolingbroke is an education consultant. Selina, your highlight of the week, please.
Traditional bank holiday for me, Jim. Sofa, snooker, family-sized bag of crisps.
The snooker. Wow, that's
fantastic. So exciting. Very
fantastic. In Manchester's famous Oxford Road Student Union building, Ben Ward is Chief Exec at the University of Manchester Student Union. Ben, your highlight of the week?
Well, actually from yesterday, so a bunch of us here spent a lot of time in Nottingham, visiting Nottingham Trent and the University of Nottingham, talking about civic engagement and working with local authorities. Really exciting pieces of work going on both in Nottingham and Manchester, and it was great to compare notes. So something really refreshing after the bank holiday weekend.
It was. I was there, cracking day out, and a cracking burger for lunch. So there we go. There's my review. And in Oxford itself, Michael Salmon is news editor at Wonky. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
Yeah, nothing really. It's been very busy, but looking forward to the celebrations this weekend because it's my partner's birthday.
Oh, well, there we go. I wondered what you were going to say then. So, yes, very good. So, we start this week with student finance. On Tuesday, the Times ran a front page on some happy polling, and then the next thing we knew, Keir Starmer was in the TV studios. Selina, what happened next?
Well, there was Keir on the airwaves admitting that it was likely that the next Labour government would move away from the pledge to scrap tuition fees. He was looking for a fairer solution, but he didn't say a lot about what fairer might look like. And the kind of rationale being that we just couldn't afford it now, whereas he felt that we could have afforded it a couple of years ago when he was pitching for Labour and possibly Labour student votes. So that was the big headlines on the Labour front, but also a couple of announcements, one from Wales in terms of the Welsh government's announcement that Wales would stick with their current system of student loan repayment and not adopt the English move to the so-called Plan 5 this September, which you'll recall means a lower payment threshold, a lower interest rate and a longer repayment term. In the past, Wales have generally followed England on this, but he says that they're sticking with their own plan because he felt that these reforms were actually regressive. And then finally, in Scotland, not good news for them. 20 million of funding that had been promised to universities back in December, and indeed 26 million promised to FE colleges, has now been withdrawn by the Scottish Government as they have other priorities. So they haven't said what those other priorities are, but I think it's suspected that it is to do with their recent pay settlement for teachers. So lots going on, but all of which speak to a system wobbling all over the place. And no real big answers.
Quite a week. Michael, you were sort of following this on Tuesday. Lots of people were speculating about why Keir Starmer would make this announcement a couple of days before the locals. But I got the impression that he was kind of bounced into this. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, it does sound like it. So the Times went with a senior party source has said there's going to be a speech later in May about tuition fees. And so it felt like he was kind of being bounced into talking about it on the Today programme. And he sort of, as Selina said, sort of, you know, hesitantly confirmed that he was going to move away from it. The Guardian this morning has said, you know, again, other party sources suggest that, he wasn't wanting to talk about it in the run-up to the local elections. And it does look a bit odd, interesting to sort of see what it does to the Labour vote. I think, you know, there's... some people see it as, you know, part of this, you know, seven dimensional chess thing of, you know, at least he's in the headlines. You know, maybe there's certain floating voters that will be attracted by this kind of thing. But I mean, it doesn't sound like that on balance. I mean, I think having more headlines about flip-flops and giving, you know, even the SNP an attack line in Parliament yesterday against him, you know, on balance, it seems like they were just sort of, it was an unplanned announcement that's come to surprisingly dominate the week.
I mean, in terms of the kind of cost of all of this, Ben, you know, obviously his rationale here is, you know, we're in different economic times. You know, one of the things I thought interesting that he hasn't actually mentioned that, you know, abolishing tuition fees has become significantly more expensive than when Corbyn promised it because of the kind of changes that the Tories have made. But I mean, you know, was this inevitable? And is it about the finances, or is it about the politics, or is it about both? I mean, what's going on?
I mean, my view is it's about both. This is one of those hot potato issues that probably needed to be dealt with by him, you know, this long away from a general election. You know, the debate always needed to be happened now. It's one of those issues that was, I think, you know, put as a promise, and look how many parties have been got by that promise over the last 20 years. The numbers just don't stack up. And what remains interesting about this is still no one is talking about the actual cost of living. We're still focused on the undergraduate fee, how high, how not high, and on all of that. No one is talking about the wider challenges with the student funding system. And until we start seeing some innovative policy on that, I think all of them are missing the point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, Selina, but I mean, you know, on the day, the other day, as usual, this kind of stream of commentators, and I'd also got the radio on, which didn't help, and there was a phone in on it, all of which were saying, you know, the interest rate needs to come down, and, you know, we're saying that the overall fee needs to come down, despite the fact that it's not really the interest rate or the overall fee that really determines how much people pay in the end. And, you know, how do we get to a point? Is public understanding about the current system a lost cause because of the way it's been designed? Or do you think there ought to be some leadership from at least one political party over how the system actually works?
I think the complexity in the current system is a big problem. And I think if you were going to have some kind of higher education commission to look at this again, I don't know whether or not it's an independent one, because I think you're right. You do need bold political leadership on this, because we kind of know what the options are. We've had enough commissions from Deering onwards to really understand what the options are. But the complexity has served a purpose, a political purpose, hasn't it, over the last sort of 10 to 15 years. I'm reminded actually of my Easter bank holiday activity, where I rewatched the film The Big Short, which of course is a film about the 2008 global crisis. But it's the complexity in that system, that the sort of sleight of hand about what you think you are fueling is not actually the activity that's happening on the ground. And I think we've arrived at that point, whereas it's not just general public knowledge of the system. I think it's also student and graduate knowledge of the system. So it's not a fair financial commitment to take on in that sense, because I don't think there is a really good understanding. But even when you talk to people who should be in the know, whether it be policymakers or indeed, you know, university administrators, I think there's quite a wide variety of understanding and knowledge about the impacts of tweaks to the current system. I think the one thing we know for sure is tweaking complex systems rarely makes them better. So, you know, I've always been in favour of, we have really got to start again.
Yeah, I mean, Michael, I did a thread on how the system works, and, you know, it was lovely that lots and lots of people said, you know, this is really interesting, this is really great. But one of my reflections was, I don't really have a kind of general audience on Twitter. I mainly have people in the sector, and if that many people are going, well, thanks for explaining it, we got a problem, haven't we?
Yeah, we do. There's everybody. It's very hard because, yeah, so he hasn't announced anything. There's kind of, at this point, not really any indication of what sort of system they're having in. They're thinking about. We hear there may be some kind of plans, or, you know, the papers have said this morning they'll be beginning to commission consulting. So it could still be quite a long way away. And London Economics this week has released some other very technical models. They've in the past done things for Labour, and it is all very complicated reading it. It's sort of, you look at these different sort of methods of stepped repayments or exploring, you know, what is really going on with Plan 5 now that the Office for National Statistics is abolishing the use of RPI from 2030? Is it, you know, how do you actually clearly communicate to people these changes? And as you said, the sort of the wider commentary, you know, beyond your thread, did show this, you know, lots of people looking at fee levels, which really is just an indication of, you know, if you ask students, you know, do you think fees should be lower? Essentially, you're sort of, at this point, what you're saying to them is, do you think your degree should have less invested on it? You know, do you think your sort of university with its precarious finances should be getting even less? So, you know, that question is sort of, as you say, really missing the point. You know, sort of thinking about the Wales announcement, I think that's very interesting, just to sort of shift away from Starmer for a minute, you know, because it's just, so they said, okay, it's going to be 30, we're going to stick with 30 years repayments, not 40, because it would be a regressive move. We want to spend the money on other things. We want to support different kinds of students. You know, that is, you know, fair play to this move, because it's not a decision that's going to massively thrill any voter in Wales. You know, I think in 30 years' time, there's going to be a few people in Wales, well, you know, quite a lot of people in Wales looking back and going, oh, look, my fee repayments are finished, but my cousin in England, who is the same year as me, has still got another 10 years. What's that about? Do I remember something from 20?
But actually, Michael, you know, one of the things I was thinking this morning, right? So that Wales and England comparison is fascinating for all sorts of reasons. So on the one hand, right, two people are sat round at the moment, you know, at a table round at a Christmas. One of them is a student from Wales and one's a student from England, and they're getting radically different maintenance support. Okay, so that is what it is. We talked about that before. You are right. One of them is going to kind of finish repaying in 30. One will finish repaying in 40 if they start in September. But of course, in the meantime, if you think about the debt level in the bottom right-hand corner of the student loan statement, one of them, you know, the student in Wales is going to feel like their debt is going up and up and up and up, unless Jeremy Miles can get the SLC to rewrite the kind of format of the student loan statement. Whereas the student in England, for all 40 years, is going to feel better off because they have less debt. And, you know, I mean, part of this just underlines how ridiculous and complicated the system is, doesn't it? But these comparisons, I suspect, are going to matter.
Yeah, they are, you know, which is why I really think, you know, fair play to Wales's Labour government that to sort of make this move when it's quite a sort of principled technocratic reform that no one's going to get particularly enthusiastic about, and as you say, could even lead to people, you know, students in Wales thinking, why is this horribly unfair RPI plus more inflation being levied on me? And, you know, we get into those conversations that hopefully in England are going to disappear, where with people misunderstanding how interest affects repayments.
Ben, let's just do a quick pivot into UCU actually here, because we hear that at UCU's Congress later in the month, there will be a debate about student number controls. And, you know, obviously for Labour, on the one hand, you know, they've tended to, you know, have this debate over the past few years about marketisation through the frame of fees or not. But if there's still a strong view that's kind of anti-marketisation, but, you know, kind of, you know, accepting of a kind of level of or type of tuition for your graduate contribution, that really is about number controls, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And look what's happening to the sector right now. You know, if you look at what's happened over the last couple of years in universities like mine, massive expansion, you know, hoovering up students that has damaged other parts of the sector. And that has huge implications on national pay bargaining, on the unit of resource being going into supporting students. Labour's, the one thing we've always known about Labour traditionally is it's been taking an expansionist attitude to higher education. And, you know, if they start getting sucked into student number controls, you know, we're then on to restricting students' ambition and so on and so on. So I think this will be a really interesting time for the sector.
Yeah, and this is it, Selena, isn't it? Because, you know, on the one hand, I suspect Labour will want to focus on, you know, making sure that the economy is supported and that local education and skills needs are developed. But on the other hand, the Tories will be busy going, well, you're an enemy of opportunity.
Yeah, but I think if you were thinking about the system and actually you wanted to, yes, contain the cost to some extent, but also still have a really strong skills output, rather than, if you like, putting constraints on the number of students in higher education, I think one thing that's never really done is there's never been an attempt to really make alternatives to higher education attractive to the student learner. So we have seen no real kind of renaissance of further education. And I really do believe that from both a learner point of view, but also from an employer point of view, that's where the next real kind of big wave of public funding in tertiary education needs to go. And I just think the kind of the optics around the politics of this, rather than talking about university number controls, actually let's make FE much, much more attractive. And I think that, you know, a lot of the students that have ended up in higher education over certainly the last 10 years, you know, could well be attracted into a cheaper form of living, a cheaper form of learning without feeling as if it is a cheaper and inferior form of learning. I think the other thing I was just going to comment on was the HEPI poll, which I do think is really interesting in that, and it's a poll of undergraduate students, so that is obviously a small slice of the young population. But there's, again, there's no obvious outcome that everybody gets behind. So, you know, less than 30% want to abandon tuition fees. Just, you know, a 20%, a fifth of them want to keep the current system. So I actually go back a long way on this issue, in that the first piece of published research that I did back in the mid-1990s was on student funding. And even then, so this is pre-tuition fees being introduced, we'd only had 5 years of maintenance loans. But even then, only 70% of students wanted free tuition. 30% accepted that there should be a contribution towards their tuition. So this has always been a very mixed issue. In my view, I think if I was sort of sitting advising a shadow minister, I would actually want to take the attention away from HE to some extent and to refocus it on FE.
Yes, and I mean that polling on that polling on student attitudes was interesting, Michael, wasn't it? Because it kind of kicked the whole week off. But then later in the week, didn't we also get some YouGov polling on kind of general population attitudes on some on similar questions?
Yeah, we did. YouGov had a sort of snap poll. I was sort of watching their website like a hawk, because as soon as the Starmer news was in, I thought, okay, YouGov will do something really quickly, and they polled about 2,500 people, you know, all adults across Great Britain. And again, similarly, you know, we got about it wasn't quite as sort of fine-grained as HEPI's in terms of, do you like 3,000, do you like 6,000, you know, but it was, you know, it did sort of explain what was meant by the different things. And we got quite a lot of people saying, you know, about a third of respondents saying tuition fees, about a third saying graduate tax, and a third saying employers should contribute-ish. I mean, and there were some interesting breakdowns with sort of Labour voters keener I said employers, but I know what I mean was general taxation. And Labour voters were more keen on general taxation, as were younger voters, I believe. You know, which is interesting, but again, just like Selena said, shows there's not really a clear consensus emerging if the way politicians are making decisions is based on, you know, trying to sort of take the temperature of what different groups of voters would be interested in. You know, that's not the right way to make these decisions. There is a bit of a need to do some sort of technocratic policy making and really deal with these sort of complex options, and then also do, you know, successfully get the optics right as well. It is complicated, and that's, I think, one thing the polls make very clear.
Ben, if all the indications are right in terms of the stuff I've seen coming out from you know, kind of some of the housing bodies and, you know, some of the, you know, agents and so on, Labour Party conference this autumn, which presumably the press will be talking up as some kind of flashpoint on issues like tuition fees, will be happening at roughly the same time that people are struggling to find somewhere to live within a reasonable price frame. And, you know, that may well happen again in Manchester, maybe not, but I mean, it certainly will be happening in lots of other cities around the country. Is this issue of kind of, you know, housing and hardship going to overtake fees at some point, do you think?
We've sort of been saying that for the last 20 years, that actually, you know, where is the plan around student living costs and maintenance? We, you know, it is in sharp focus now because of the sudden growth in universities in particular parts of the country and the cost of living crisis. But it's always been there. And so, you know, what we've seen over the last 10 years is a, you know, huge growth in the purpose-built student accommodation market that has driven the prices up to unaffordable levels, hostile councils making it more difficult for cheaper HMOs to operate, and so on and so on. So that's going on. Meanwhile, the thing that really interested me about the HEPI poll is around how much money do you think students would be provided with maintenance each year, not including tuition fees? And, you know, broadly speaking, it's about where it is now, but just a bit more to make it easy. And I still think, you know, we are not talking enough around the derisory increase for the maintenance loans next year. And I haven't heard any party take this on at all. You know, housing is always, university housing is always seen as an issue for the Department of Education rather than the Department for Communities and Local Government, and so on and so on. And so, until we start seeing some real debate around the type of higher education we have in this country, whether the moving away from home model needs to remain the dominant feature of it, and I do agree with Selena around the role of further education, still the poor middle child, 17 years after the report that named it so. So there's lots going on here that Labour could get their teeth into if they wanted to. But I fear it will once again be reductive. Fees how high? Fees whether at all? Graduate tax, yes or not really? And so on and so on.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Libby Homer, Director of Student and Library Services at Anglia Ruskin University and co-chair of Sconnel. This week, I have written about the new deal struck with Springer Nature and, whilst accepting it, the significant reservations expressed by the library sector. Read how you and your colleagues can promote open access at your institutions and more widely, so that we can truly transform our next set of negotiations. There are 7 simple actions that you can take to support open access, including questioning both walled gardens and the article processing charges you're being asked to pay, and also utilising your institution's rights retention statement. Help us transform before we face a similar situation with open monographs.
Now, next up, UKRI has announced a stipend increase, but Michael, all was not as it initially seemed.
That's right. Jim, I think this was a bit of the curse of wonkies watching, you know, for announcements like a hawk. And so when we looked onto the page, we saw a 6.3% increase. And however, that was quickly updated, and UKRI told us that it was a sort of error on their side, that they'd put sort of outdated information there, and it was actually a 5.3% increase for next academic year to the postgraduate stipend for those funded by UKRI. Of course, other studentships across the sector generally follow suit, so the full-time equivalent of that is £18,622. It's been a bit of an ongoing saga anyway. It's usually set in January, but they've been sort of briefing and trailing that, you know, the kind of volatile climate and the sort of, you know, lack of clarity on what inflation levels are going to be like has meant they've been delaying it, and maybe seeing how much money and what their sort of institutions are telling them. And there's probably an extent to which, you know, so obviously 5.3% is below inflation as it stands and as it was in September. But, you know, there's an extent to which they probably overshot last year with what ended up being a 13% increase to the stipend for the current year. You know, it looks 5.3%. It looks worse than 6.3% as we sort of spotted originally. But it does look quite a lot better than the 2.8 that Ben has just mentioned for undergraduates in England, and, you know, and quite a bit worse than, say, undergraduates in Wales who've got their maintenance linked to the living wage. So it's a kind of medium news, but you know, there was a little sort of some interesting details in how it came out, you've written about this on the site. And you know, there's also the question of the number of studentships. Obviously, if they're better funded, you know, and you're talking about a fixed set of money going to it, that means there's going to be fewer of them. And so we think there was maybe, I don't want to sort of speculate too much, but it feels from what people in the sector have told us that, you know, originally they were planning to reduce the number of studentships, and now that sort of that plan has been I don't want to say flip-flopped on, but it, you know, has been
revised.
Revised. Yeah, sorry, I've got Keir Starmer in my head. I think I don't want to be unfair to UKRI, but they, you know, they've revised the plan and made the stipend a little less generous in order to avoid reducing the number of studentships.
Ben, obviously, you know, all of this is to some extent a part of this wider program of work for UKRI on a new deal for postgraduate researchers. But if it is a new deal, I'm not sure what the deal consists of, because it isn't clear, is it, how much money PGRs need to live on, and therefore no. It's really hard to judge whether or not the increase is too high or too low or what, you know.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things I was reflecting on the other day, it's interesting how PGRs students are generally treated in universities rather like students are treated by government, as in they're isolated into one department. You know, if I think that PGR support departments are often responsible for employment, welfare, housing, pastoral care, relationships with supervisors, and so on. There needs to be, I think, a real step back from the sector about the PGR student experience, what it means all round. What support do they need to live? How are they employed? You know, some national standards around employment for casual teaching and so on. But at the moment, there's no one really advocating for that, other than obviously the industrial action that is focused on general casualisation in the sector.
Yes, Selina, can you think of we have a national pay spine for academics. We have, you know, a kind of national stipend level, at least suggested by UKRI. Is there a justification for the amount that we pay PGRs who teach to be radically different in every institution on an hourly rate basis? You know, on what basis would that be okay? I've been trying to work that out.
I don't think so. And I don't think most students who've been taught by PGR students would think so. You just sort of think, well, that stipend is below minimum wage, you know, as an annualised figure. So there is a presumption of employment around it. I think that regardless of what your status is, I think, you know, where you go on the teaching pay scale should be about the experience you've got. So they may be at the lower end, but I don't think that they should have or be treated as a different category of worker.
And on these kind of wider questions of support, why are we in this position where it's UKRI talking about the kind of student experience offer for PGRs, and we don't really hear of anything from OFS? You know, is that what's going on?
Yeah, well, I think you're starting to delve into this sort of the kind of real problems with it's not the remit of OFS, it's the interpretation of the remit of OFS that I think is problematic. You know, it is playing to the biggest audience constantly. And PGR, you know, their student experience is just as important as an undergraduate student experience, but there is little interest and little oversight from the regulator.
I go back to some of the structural challenges locally and nationally around, you know, the division of where remits start and end. So if you imagine in a university, you will often have a Pro Vice Chancellor for Teaching, Learning and Student Experience, which will include undergraduate and PGT students, and a Pro Vice Chancellor for Research that will include PGR students. And that then is ratioed up towards OFS and UKRI. So the student representative bodies, although, you know, we've now taken the decision to have a postgraduate research specific officer to start work on this, to, you know, student unions aren't particularly great at it, and US hasn't been great at it. UCU comes at it, I think, from a pay and conditions point of view, which of course is its remit. I wonder if there is just something else missing that needs to join some of these dots.
And actually, Michael, really, I guess the original prospect of that New Deal work was all going to be about, you know, thinking about careers and the kind of overall future of the kind of profession, really, of kind of being an academic. But This issue of the stipend appears to have kind of ground a lot of that work to a halt.
Yeah, it does. It does. So, you know, alongside the stipend announcement, we had a sort of summary of consultations they've had from across the sector. Loads of students answered it. They've got a kind of analysis, a thematic analysis has been done of what people said. The UKRI response is still forthcoming. It will be later this year. And there's all kinds of ideas that, as you've said, it's not just about finance. People are talking about conditions, pathways, supervisory practices, relationships, all these different things. There is a bit of a sense that the PGR New Deal can't come soon enough at this point. It feels like it's been quite a long time coming. It also feels a bit, and this is partly to do with these arguments that have been had around the stipend and the campaigning work that's been done on it, that the expense of a really satisfying New Deal that does what people, from all across the sector, but students especially, need it to do, is going to be quite tough to achieve.
Now, someone who knows a lot about PGRs and research, but also knows a lot about hanging around, is our colleague, James Coe.
Hi, it's James here, Associate Editor for Research and Innovation. And this week, I've not been writing about research innovation. I've instead been thinking about my university days and the joy of just hanging out. When I think about when I went to university a decade ago, the most fun I had was those long expanses of time dedicated to not doing much at all. In my piece for Wonky this week, The Slow Death of Hanging Out, I argued that rather than those times having no value whatsoever, we should instead do all we can to preserve them. It's my belief that in those moments of that repeated engagement with people who we like and who we know, it's where we build those communities that so much of the structured time is dedicated to. Alongside the cost of living and this drumbeat that the only time that is productive is time that is filled, we risk squeezing out the time for just hanging out. If we do that, time to do nothing will become a luxury afforded to only the best off. I think time to simply hang out is the next big political issue that students' unions and universities should be engaged with.
Now, next up, there's a new report out on giving to universities, Ben.
Yes, there is. So the Case Ross Supportive Education Survey, now in its 20th year, looks at higher education institutions across the UK and Ireland. So 88 participating institutions looking at fundraising, alumni donations and philanthropy. So headline figures to look at really look fairly promising for the sector, although as ever in the higher education sector, there's the haves and have-nots. But funds committed have jumped by 31% in the last year to £1.49 billion. But as I said before, two elite institutions, I think we could probably name who they are, dominating the totals, followed by another 10 or so strongly performing universities and a long tail. Number of donors has decreased, but we just see actually, in terms of alumni donations, only 0.8% of the 15.7 million total alumni for those institutions report as making contributions. So there isn't, we've talked for many years around getting to a culture of philanthropy that exists in many other countries, particularly when we look longingly to the US. Really interesting report, and certainly from what I've seen is that universities really do seem to be upping their game in terms of fundraising. You only have to look at the number of jobs now available in development, fundraising, alumni relations that are advertised on any of the sector job sites.
Now, Selena, I'm all for people giving money to universities, but obviously, we know that some universities produce richer graduates than others. And there is a danger, isn't there, if the world says to itself, well, let's depend more on philanthropy than public funding, that the richer institutions get richer and vice versa.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's two kind of there's two stories within this in terms of development funding. There's the alumni side of it, which, as Ben says, no surprise that has, not increase, so it's a marginal decrease, but we've now got that set of graduates who are getting the calls from student fundraisers to make their regular monthly contributions. They at the same time are seeing their pay packets with their 9% contribution to their student loans and not feeling as generous as generations of alumni in the past. That is no surprise. I think that has been predicted, and I think certainly the institutions that I've worked with are more interested actually in the non-financial giving that alumni can contribute to institutional life, which is really important. The mentoring, the talks, the access to workplace experiences. And then I think there is the sort of more traditional philanthropic donors. And I think what I was talking to actually a development professional a couple of weeks ago, and they had a background in not just higher education, but in the arts sector as well. And they said, you know, the thing about fundraising these days is that it is always something for something in a much more explicit and tailored way than had perhaps been the case in the past. And when you are in that kind of funding proposition, there's no way that that kind of funding can be viable as a kind of source of alternative support for your core cost. So you may want to go out and sort of seek a donor for, you know, a new building. They love new buildings, naming rights and all the rest of it. But the institution always has to put far more into that building. And unless that building in itself is something that's going to increase revenues, which will contribute to your core costs in the future, it's not going to help with the wider system of balancing your budget. And I think the other thing that kind of just is the kind of concern around this, and Case make this point, and actually they make it as a positive, which is what this research shows is that if you increase development staffing, you will get increased awards. And I think for a lot of us that have worked in those institutions that are not in the top 10 of fundraisers, that creates a real tension about where your sort of investment funding year on year, when you do get a little bit of budget to spend on something new, is going. And there is no guarantee of returns. There never is.
Yes, that kind of hierarchy of fundraising is obviously very common in the wider voluntary sector, Michael, where, you know, the really big high profile charities, you know, their sort of bang for buck when they spend a bit of money on a fundraiser is very different to, you know, many other charities. And, you know, there are all sorts of ethical questions, actually, aren't there, about what people want for the money, how much you spend to raise it, whether you can depend on it for a long time. All sorts of ethical questions come up if this is the direction of travel.
Yeah, they definitely do. I think it's a really interesting area. A question about how much universities spend in order to attract donations. You know, so we see here the sort of, I think, 10 or so of what the report calls the fragile institutions, where their programs are, you know, you could say nascent or, you know, or struggling possibly. I mean, they're bringing in an average of £80,000 from donations. I mean, does that fund an alumni office, a fundraising team? Not by a long way. There's also quite a dwindling response rate to this survey. It got a lot more sort of a decade ago. Whether that is that about less successful institutions, so, you know, being forced to disengage a bit from fundraising? Possibly. But, you know, and yeah, this report is entirely about the money coming into the institutions that responded. Is not at all about where that money goes, which is a really, really interesting question. Because, you know, on the one side, you've got these sort of the big stellar, you know, big ticket donations, you know, which often bring institutions negative publicity, you know, from certain sources. There's a lot of talk in the report about the importance of due diligence. You know, but when we're talking about multi-million pound donations, that, you know, it's becomes tricky for universities to really do due diligence. To the level that many of their employees would expect them to do. You know, university staff really have quite high expectations for the probity of their institutions. If I walk around my local area, I can see buildings named after people who've been linked with arms dealing, who've been linked with the opioid crisis in the USA.
You should do walking tours, Michael.
I imagine those things exist. And, you know, so there's that side of things. But, you know, as Selena says, there's also really interesting possibilities around getting your alumni connected back with your education strategies. And you do see this now more and more in education strategies that are thinking about, you know, how do alumni contribute, whether that's through their time, their expertise, whether it's for specific funding for really interesting programs. You know, there's one institution I'm very familiar with, a program that where they have funded through alumni funding undergraduate research placements for students, where they're paired with an academic and they're given a stipend. It's not just free, they're actually also subsidized because it's during the summer, so their living cost pays, and they're involved in an undergraduate research project, and many of them publish articles out of it. You know, it's really interesting. And that relationship between alumni and education is, you know, the question of what an alumni is really made more interesting by the LLE as well, because an alumni stops being someone who's finished. It becomes someone who is, you know, just in the world of work, but maybe coming back, you know, possibly if touch wood, the LLE all goes well and it does what it's supposed to.
Yeah, no, I was just about to agree with that. I think there's some fascinating projects in relation to student success, employability, ensuring that those students who might not be able to have a pre-existing network to help them get a network of people that have been through the institution. So, you know, start to address some of those inequalities using both the money donated, but also, you know, alumni working in roles and in organisations that students want access to. And I think that has been a fantastic turn for the sector. And more of that, please.
Now it's time for Play Your Data Right. Here to set this week's wage conundrum is Wonky's Associate Editor, David Kernahan.
In a format devised for Wonky exclusively by Prince Edward's production company, I'm delighted to bring you a very special It's a Royal Play Your Leo Data Right. We're looking today at three kids, all of whom grew up on an estate, William, Beatrice and Eugenie, all of which attended UK universities. William graduated with a degree in geography from St Andrews. Beatrice holds a degree in history from Goldsmiths, and Eugenie majored in English at Newcastle. The game here is to rank them by the average salary the most recent cohort on those courses could expect to see 5 years after graduation, according to the latest Leo data. William, Beatrice and Eugenie, who will win?
I would say geography would be top. Then I would say history, then English. Well, subject largely, but also a little bit of institution with the top one.
Yeah, I would say St Andrews geography top, Newcastle second, and Goldsmiths history third.
Yeah, hard to argue with that, really. I think I will also put geography top and history at Goldsmiths. No, maybe I'll say that second, and English at Newcastle third. I mean, it's an interesting question how well the Royals show up in the Leo data.
So, 5 years after graduation, William, St Andrews, geography, could expect a median salary of £32,600, topping our list. Eugenie, Newcastle, English, could expect £27,100, giving her second place, with her elder sister, Beatrice, Goldsmiths history, looking at £26,400 and third place. Now, I've checked the SOC codes and it turns out heir to the throne isn't listed, so I'll have to assume that William doesn't have a graduate job, dragging down St Andrews graduate outcome statistics. But in Scotland, that isn't as important as the fact Balmoral is in SIMD quintile 4. Beatrice is a strategist for a US software company, a graduate job, and that's good news for Goldsmith's B3 data, although as she lives overseas, they're going to struggle to get her to fill in the graduate outcomes form. And Eugenie is a director of a gallery, a graduate job, and that's a good news for Newcastle's B3 stats.
Now, finally this week, higher education has economic benefits for disadvantaged students, but it's not quite that simple, is it, Selina?
No, it is not that simple. So this is a new report from TASO that has found that higher education is linked to clear economic benefits for disadvantaged students, but these students earn less than more advantaged graduates. So that takes account of the university they attended or the subjects studied. So the report is drawing on data from the UK Household Longitudinal Survey and looks at the soft benefits in university outcomes, so well-being, mental health, social capital. And what it's going to look at is whether or not those demonstrated benefits can be explained by the fact that graduates are more likely to be younger, better off and employed than the general population. And they find that a significant relationship between university study and social capital outcomes, such as the number of close friends and reduced loneliness. So overall, university, a good thing, but the comparative level of disadvantage still exists.
Michael, do we get a sense from this of why? You know, what is going on here? Isn't the idea that once you kind of get in, you're on the same level as everyone and then you can fly? You know, why is it that, you know, albeit that higher education generally is better than not being in higher education from this kind of economic point of view, why is it that there's still this kind of hierarchy based on previous advantage when people leave?
So the question is, why do rich families produce rich? I mean, you know, yeah, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, and it kind of maybe goes back to this, you know, Leo data thing we're talking about here, where, you know, your wealth isn't just about your earnings. It's the whole, you know, it's the land you own, it's the property, it's the capital gains as well. These things that sort of don't quite show up in graduate outcomes in the same way. I mean, but you know, it's also about the, you know, the social capital, the cultural capital that you come with, the connections, the networks, the places you're in as well. And, you know, are you in the right place? Are you able to, you know, do an internship? Can your parents fund you while you do further study? All these different things. I think this side of the report is, you know, perhaps not particularly surprising, but I do think these TESO reports, that, and they're really on a roll with them at the moment, are sort of, you know, clear evidence-based stuff designed for policymakers and for you know, I think they're a really good thing, and they're always worth reading.
Ben, in terms of what's kind of happening, you know, in the actual real world, you know, on campus, one of the stories I often tell, I think I've told it before on the podcast, is Steve Smith, you know, off of previous VC at Exeter and now international education champion, gave an interview to The Guardian 4 or 5 years ago where he said, look, the thing about getting into university is it's a leveler. You know, once you're in, you're on the same level as everyone else. But, you know, the actual day-to-day lived reality of that isn't quite like that, is it, in terms of access to internships or, getting into extra debt to pay for your rent or whatever?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's one of the interesting pieces of work I've always wanted to do, and I think we're starting to look at it now, is actually are leadership positions in extracurricular activities actually reinforcing inequalities or doing something about them? Because, you know, there's all sorts of things that students who are used to joining in things, having the money to do so, can do that others can't. Interestingly, from the other end, there's all employers play a role in this as well. You know, universities are proud at being targeted by employers, which is also has a inequality reinforcing effect. So, you know, students that went to particular universities who are now in jobs in some of the top graduate recruiters will recruit like for like. And so there's a number of things to do it. And the thing that stands out for me in the TESO report more than anything, and it's like reading everything I've ever read in the last 20 years around the sector, is the lack of high quality information, advice and guidance for students applying to university. Pre-entry information, advice, guidance in schools and colleges is still woefully inadequate, and therein lies one of the major problems.
Selena, obviously most people's kind of base instinct in the sector, and I understand why, is that opportunity really matters, and if we can get someone that's disadvantaged into higher education, get them through their program, you know, that's a good thing. But doesn't evidence like this start to raise kind of questions about whether or not actually there are a huge chunk of students in higher education right now who might not be better off, actually, and certainly won't be kind of cheating the old system in terms of social mobility?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it goes back, actually, to what Ben has said. I mean, it isn't, higher education is not a leveler. There is still a very different terrain. Students have a very different student experience depending on what their financial circumstances are whilst they study. Their family financial circumstances will have an impact on even what they choose to do on graduation. You know, how much time they can spend, you know, searching out the right graduate career, taking on unpaid or poorly paid internships. But I think, you know, Ben makes the point of picking out of the TESO report the point about pre-entry information, advice and guidance. I mean, I couldn't agree more. It is woefully funded in the school sector. Most advice and guidance, you know, comes from teachers who are reflecting on their own university experience, which, as we know, will have changed a lot. And probably that's the best kind of advice and guidance that many students get, because advice and guidance around alternative options to university is even more thin. But I think as part of that guidance, there needs to be a really informed consideration of what it means in terms of the financial outcomes, as well as the academic outcomes and the wellbeing outcomes. I'd like to think, as a, you know, an advocate of the sector, there are many more gains than negatives with going to university. But I also think that you have to see that in the context of what the alternatives are. And until we have got much, much better, properly funded pre-entry advice and guidance, not just in terms of university, but just what your post-16 options are, then I don't think that young people are equipped to really make a proper judgment.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Selena, Ben, Michael, who also makes the show happen behind the scenes. Mark will be here next week, and until then, stay wonky.